Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to day three of the first annual Overlook Film Festival. I'm Lena Zach. I'm one of the co-directors. Thanks so much for coming to today's immersive panel. I know you all really want to hear what they have to say, so we'll get to that in just a second. Just wanted to let you all know that we have some really fantastic events today and tomorrow. In here, in this very space at 4 p.m., is a very unmissable live audio drama, Tales from Beyond the Pale, by iconic horror filmmakers Larry Fessenden and Glenn McQuaid. They're writing an original, two original stories for us, cast by actors throughout the festival. If anybody was in here yesterday to see the Pumpkin Pie Show, the live storytelling event, he's got some scheduled one-on-ones that you can do and get your own personalized storytelling today and tomorrow. There's a waiting area just outside this room. Roger Corman will be here at 5:45 to receive our Master of Horror Award in the Ullman Hall. A secret screening is our closing night film, and if you get shut out of that, we're playing an amazing film called Hounds of Love in the other theater at the same time. We've got some wacky midnight movies, and tomorrow we've got some amazing special events, including our family-friendly screening of Paranorman, and we will have representatives of Leica here. We've got a film called Capture, which involves phone technology, so you will be able to interact with your phone with the film, and that's going on tomorrow as well, and a whole other day of screenings. So I want to thank everybody for coming out, and let's get this panel started. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Brian Bishop. I'm a senior reporter at The Verge, and thanks for coming out to Scare Tactics, Making Immersive Work. One of the really cool things here that I'm enjoying about the Overlook Film Festival is that the focus just hasn't been on great scary movies. It's been on great immersive experiences, right? And that's a pretty broad phrase that, as we've seen, can mean anything from VR to very, very intense immersive theater to a four-day, you know, hunt for a serial killer where a questionable security force arrests an innocent man. Not saying anything in particular, Dylan, but anyway, it's an interactive art form. I think some of the most exciting and immersive work is happening, and so I'm really, really stoked to introduce today's panelists right here from Chalet and the ABC Project, Andy Lesser. Next up, Chris Thor and Josh Mandel, the creators of Blackout. And Dylan Reef, mastermind at Bottleneck Immersive, who's behind this weekend's insane immersive horror game. So just in case everybody in the room here hasn't had a chance to try all these experiences, I was hoping you could all kind of go down and describe, you know, the shows you have here at the festival and kind of how they came to be.
Okay, so my show is called The Chalet for the Festival, but it's really Apartment 8, which is the first show in the ABC project. It is an immersive experience, kind of the idea that you... I mean, it's hard to say anything without spoiling it. I don't know, because it's such a short experience. But it's kind of just the idea of facing someone else's inner demons and leaning it to face your personal inner demons. I wrote the show originally to be done in my apartment, and I was having trouble coming up with the title, and I was talking to my actor, and I was like, what if we just call it Apartment 8? And then it's an A, because I was also kind of trying to game the system. It was for a festival. I was like, I want it to be as close to the top alphabetically in the program as possible, so people see it first when they're looking for the program. And I was like, what if we just call it Apartment 8? And then what if we just, like, keep going with the letters of the alphabet, because I was thinking of the whole alphabetical. And then I just came up with the ABC Project, where I find a venue, I write a show for the venue the same way I was writing a show for my apartment, and I'm continuing all the letters of the alphabet and just finding the venue that starts with each letter. And after I find a venue that inspires me, I write it for the venue, and I incorporate as many aspects of the space as I can.
Okay, hi. So I'm Josh. Chris and I created Blackout. Blackout started in 2009 in New York. It's basically an immersive horror experience designed to be walked through alone. You have to be over 18 to go through it. It's pretty aggressive and physical. You have to sign a waiver before going through. And it started as a theater project. And just a really quick kind of funny story to go off of what you just said. Before Blackout was called Blackout, the title of the show was actually called Haunted House, and it was nothing more than a marketing, same exact thing. I just wanted people to go into Google and type NYC haunted house, and that would be the first thing to pop up. So we shared creating titles, I guess. But that's how Blackout started in 2009, and that's what we're doing here.
Hey guys, pardon my voice, but I'm Dylan Reef. I am the architect of the immersive horror game. It's a yearly chance to live inside of a horror movie for a couple days with puzzles and narratives, and it carries over from year to year, so you live in the same story world. So some characters you'll have known for many years. And it's just a really interactive way to socialize and immerse yourself in something kind of eerie or scary and get to live inside of a movie for a couple days.
So it's, you know, we're at a horror festival, so I guess an important question to start with is, you know, why is immersive a good fit, you know, for horror? There's all different flavors of everything going on here, but all of you here are using, you know, horror ideas or tropes or themes to get at various different things. I know the obvious answer is that, like, it's first-person stakes, right? If somebody's coming at you with an axe, that's scarier than somebody at a screen getting, you know, taken out with an axe. But all the shows here are more than that. You know, Blackout, Chalet, they're very psychological. So can you talk about, you know, why that fit works for immersive?
Jump in. I think one of the things that that horror is so, it fits so well, is the idea of sort of making yourself a protagonist and asking yourself, because you watch a horror movie and there's a lot of jump scares, but I think one of the things that immersive can add to it is allowing yourself to explore your own fears and why you are afraid of what you are, and sort of it's a chance to take something that's can be a little bit sort of over the top and like gory and blah, and actually ask yourself sort of why are these things scary and why am I doing this to myself? And I think horror is the sort of the most extreme of these things, asking that sort of empathic first person question of why do these things scare us and why do we do these things? And I think horror lends itself really well to that.
Just kind of jumping off of that, I don't necessarily think of my pieces as like scary or horror necessarily, but I do think that my pieces have a lot to do with who you are as a person, and a lot of people spend all of their days pretending to be what they want other people to see them as, and it's hard a lot of times for people to have introspection on themselves, and it's frightening for people a lot of times to think about themselves in a negative light or in a light, maybe sometimes it's even scary to think about yourself in a positive light. It's hard to see yourself beyond these mental constructs you've made about yourself. And so I feel a lot of what I try and do with my piece is to kind of go at what people are insecure and afraid of about who they are as people and work through a lot of that.
I guess for me, what I really enjoy about horror is that it's a plain clothes genre for players. So in terms of play, you don't have to put on a suit of armor or like a detective's slicker and go out and be a gumshoe. You just are yourself until something jumps out and gets you. And I think it's a lot easier for people to connect with the play aspect without having to put on a costume. So it's basically tricking you to LARP without a sword.
Very true. Another thing I've been struck by, kind of going through all of your pieces this weekend, is just the importance of atmosphere. Yesterday in the game, this like frenzy paranoia really took hold, that culminated last night in a really, really fantastic way. And without getting into details, you know, Annie and Josh and Chris, your show's atmosphere just yes. But at the same time, you're pulling that off, you know, dealing with, you know, hotel rooms, found locations, right? I'm wondering if you can talk about the tension between pulling off that atmosphere, how important it is, and working with the limitations of the locations.
I'll start. I mean, I actually, something Annie said earlier about creating shows based on the venue is also something that Chris and I do a lot as well. So for us, the actual space that we're in dictates so much of what ends up happening in the show. Obviously, with any immersive experience, it's, you know, mood, atmosphere, it's about the environment that you're in. So I think the step number one going into any new space is how do you utilize that space to create the most specific, unique environment that you can. It's really about teasing out the very specific architectural elements of each and every room. And we have several shows that have happened in hotel rooms, RVs, cargo vans, warehouses, art galleries, cars. We've done it everywhere, but and it's never really been by choice. It's a boat. We did one, and so it's always. Yeah, so, but it's always that, like, we find this venue, and we're like, holy shit, this is amazing. Let's create something for this. So I think they really go hand in hand, actually.
And I think just to piggyback on that, the one thing, too, is that in, like, the architecture of the space, you can really feel the sort of circle, peg, square, hole thing. So you can't say, I have this idea, and you can't force it into a space if it's not natural in that space. And you feel it, I think, in immersive, especially site-specific immersive. You feel it more than anything else. So you have to, a lot of times, you have to really let go of something that you thought was going to be this kick-ass idea because it's just not going to work there.
Right. With a lot of the bottleneck immersive projects that we do, we don't always have a lot of say over the spaces. So it's kind of fitting it into where it can exist. And you know, my job then is just how do I take what makes this space unique and interesting already and grow that out. So take its best characteristics and explore those, even when there sometimes are few best characteristics in a certain space. But yeah, you have it's just basically solution based. It's like taking a space and what's the best solution we can create out of what we're given and the resources you have to make something exist there that brings people, that doesn't take people out of the experience.
Can I go a little more like cerebral for a second?
Absolutely.
So I agree with everything that was said so far, and that's usually like what I go to first when I would answer a question like that, but I'd just like to point out how many people have read Tom Stoppard or seen a performance of Tom Stoppard's Arcadia here? You know, okay, so the idea behind Tom Stoppard's Arcadia is it is a play where it starts out, I'm trying to remember, because it just literally, it moves back and forth between being in the same house in 1899 and 1999 or something like that. Like, it's a 100-year difference. But you're going, oscillating back and forth between these different storylines inside this space, and they start to bleed together until both storylines are taking place on the stage at the same time. And I feel like that is, that's a metaphor for the fact that spaces have a history to them. And sometimes you can kind of even feel the memory of a place. You can sense it. And I feel like it's a extension of like Jung's idea of the collective unconscious. But we have similar reactions to being in a space. It's kind of also the reason why, you know, architects like rely on certain types of geometry or different things in a space to create visual things. There was a cafe that I go to a lot in New York when I really needed to get work done my freshman year of college that was by me, because just everyone around you was doing work and it kind of buzzes into you that this is what this space is for. Like everyone having a similar reaction to a sculpture. So a space has a tone to it that if you go with it, you can, I feel, unlock so much more in an authentic experience.
And how have you noticed that? Because very specifically, like the ABC project, like your pieces are named after the location.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How has that evolved as you've done that?
I really like just try and like, I go to the space, I walk around the space, I just try and take notice of little things. So for my second show, Barbershop, I just went and I walked around the space where I was doing it. I noticed after like 5 minutes, I was like, hey, they keep a chess set up front. I should write something including the chess set. Hey, the past two times and this time I visited here, the screens always seem to be playing reality TV. I should incorporate something with reality TV playing on the TVs in the background in the barbershop. When I went to Covell, I was like, there's this vintage wallpaper that they said is like the nicest thing, like not the only thing we have to worry about is damaging the vintage wallpaper. It's like really old and it's really nice and they spent a lot of money on it. And it has these birds and I incorporated that into the script. I incorporated the big table in the room into the script. I incorporated the bathroom near the, there's like a giant light bulb for like these VIP experiences. I incorporated that into it. I try and incorporate just things about, small details about the space. I incorporate the fact that Covell was a wine bar I incorporated the wine into the storyline. I try and make sure that everything that feels like it's part of the space is part of the space when I write my scripts. The same way that when I write, what I do is I kind of find the space and then I outline the stuff that I want and then I interview all of my actors and I write for my actors too, because I feel like if you write something for the actor and you write something for the space, it's going to feel more natural. So people are going to feel authentic in their experiences. You want it to feel as real as possible. You want to completely get rid of the line between what is, you want to completely destroy the proscenium. You want to have it just be there. And because you want your audience to forget they're in a theater piece.
That's interesting. A big part of that, too, is this concept of trust, right? Because you, as creators, and your cast has to trust the audience member to be in these intimate, vulnerable, sometimes violent, aggressive situations. And the audience, as well, has to do that, or else the whole thing kind of, like, falls apart. You know, I'm wondering, how do you work to kind of, like, establish that bond with the audience from the outset? Especially sometimes when, you know, in Blackout, you kind of want to be behind a veil to a certain degree because that's part of the mystique. Like, how do you deal with that, like, conundrum?
I feel like when you have someone at first sign a waiver, even if you don't do everything that you say in the waiver, it mentally prepares them to be like, I'm giving myself up and I trust you to take care of me. I think that that is a big thing.
I agree totally. And I think the other thing, you know, interestingly enough, a lot of the evolution through Blackout of getting more and more physical with audience members had a lot to do with safety and control and keeping us safe. You know what I mean? Because sometimes if you're at an arm's length, you actually, there's a lot of flailing that can happen. But if you actually embrace someone and really get very physical with them, you have all the control, you have the balance. And this person who might be sort of flailing or not in a mental state to sort of be safe, you can keep them safe, but also create this sort of very intense moment that feels aggressive, but is actually a moment of, for us, it's a way to keep the audience member safe. So one of the things I think that a lot of people think is that we're coming in to be very, very physical all the time, but a lot of times it's actually born out of the logistical fact that we don't want to hurt anybody, you know what I mean? So I think that's an important aspect of it.
It definitely does not play, like you said, when you're in here, yeah. What about you, Dylan? Because you have a much larger scale where it's like that thing last night was, you know, it was like a huge production with everybody running around and...
Yeah, I mean, for my work, it's anytime you introduce some elements of puzzles or objectives, it changes the nature of the relationship with the characters to the players or the audience. So you'll get players who just go up to an actor or a character and just start asking questions that a normal human wouldn't ever ask. You know, you would just go up to someone and say, like, do you know where the red Blue Robin is, and the seventh seal, and the square, and the circle, but you do that to these characters just because you feel like they're supposed to spout information. But I think the people that, you know, people play very differently. Sometimes you get people who, you know, console one of our actors after something traumatic happens, and but anytime you do introduce that, it really comes a lot to the actor training, because a lot of it, you know, it's all in the moment, it's all improvised, and you just have to react as you would with a normal human. If someone came up to you and started shouting questions at you, you would probably say, you know, you're acting kind of like a jerk. You're acting like not a normal person. And I hope, and I work towards moving, training our actors and working with them to be like, yeah, talk to these people like real people, and they'll respond to you like real people. And that's kind of, that coupled with orientation is a way we work towards, like, that safety. When we're treating each other like humans, we get a lot safer.
Right. I'll also add, too, that I think with Blackout specifically, we've been really lucky. We've been running for 8 years now, and it's taken a really, really, maybe not a really long time, but it took probably about maybe 3 or 4 years before everybody coming into Blackout at this point generally knows what... They don't know what's about to happen to them, but they know who we are. They know the kind of show that they've signed up for. They know what they've paid for. So there was a lot of stuff out, you know, just written about Blackout that I think people can start trusting us in a way just by the number of years we've been running. And so I think that there's a little bit of trust that we get sometimes that's taken many years to get to. And the first 3 or 4 years, however, You know, the police were called every 2 seconds. We would just the lawsuits. So we don't really deal with that so much anymore. And so it's interesting to see how I think the audience is trusting us more now, just because there's a little bit more information out there about maybe what to expect.
I think the flip side of that, though, is, you know, anticipation, right? Because you know you're going to be in, for Blackout specifically, you're in for, like, a very intense experience, and you guys play with that with, you know, you have emails that go out, and, you know, without giving anything specific, like, you kind of play with that. Like, how do you, you know, knowing that you have that trust, what buttons do you push ahead of time to get people primed for the show when they show up?
Well, I think that's key, is that, like, once we sort of, you know, clued into the fact that it's all about anticipation, it's all about the setup and the lead-up to them actually walking into the room, you know, then it just becomes sort of exploring all the ways that you can tease that out before they get into your space. That can be email, that can be phone calls, that can be Facebook, social media stuff, and I think over 8 years we've done a lot to tease that out, but that said, it is probably the single most important thing to prime them before they even knock on that hotel room door, because if you just walk into it not nervous, it's just not going
to
work.
And I'm sure that you guys feel this as well, but like you start to think about the it's not the moment they buy the ticket, it's the moment they hear about the show when the show starts, you know what I mean? And you have to sort of be open to that, and once you get, I think once you sort of discover that, it actually becomes the most fun part of making the experience and asking, like, what should they read about it? What should be on the Facebook page? What kind of emails should they be getting? Should they be getting a call, you know, or a text message in the middle of the night 2 weeks beforehand? You know what I mean? And that's, I think, becomes the most delicious part of making it.
Yeah,
stuff like that.
Right. Yeah. What about you, Andy? Because I think as immersive evolves, there is that idea of taking that idea and adding it even to non-horror pieces, right? Whether it's, you know, some shows are going really heavy with, like, heavy ARG elements at the front, but some shows are just doing, like, small contacts and reach out. So have you thought about playing with that with ABC shows at all?
Not necessarily with ABC project. Like, maybe I'll do another thing, like, simultaneously, but I don't really, I don't think about, because I feel like the whole point about the ABC project is each show is supposed to be individualized one-off show. I've thought about maybe for I doing like Instagram, like doing something through that, but I think that the point part of the show is that it's for the space and it's in the space, and it's not, I don't want it to be outside of the space. I think it's more special that it's just held there.
Right. Makes sense. We've been talking about a lot of these things as experiences, but this is also storytelling, right, to various degrees. And I guess I'm just curious, you've all been doing this for a long time. I'm wondering how that's evolved your sense of how an audience in an immersive piece experiences story versus how they would in a passive piece. And I guess I'll go to you first, Dylan, just because you have, this is like a years-long-form narrative you were doing here at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I have an outline of what I want to happen, and then there's the reality of what does happen, and then there's how you marry the two to give the best experience to the people that are in it. So if there is a little room for people to explore with their own creativity as they play, along the tracks and story, the story tracks of the narrative, then say something emerges that I wasn't expecting, I might want to lean into that because it seems like people are really enjoying it. So then you can kind of take that little bud and grow it into another story track because people already have been imagining it and seeing it. Because there are certain things when you get to such a wide and broad experience, there's no way to control every aspect of it. So people are going to see things that are beautiful and really wonderful that I didn't expect. And so if that happens, I want to be able to like foster that idea and build it along with the story we have. So those are the moments that I think are really exciting too, when a player, I can validate what a player was imagining or feeling alongside the story.
Right. And how long has this piece been running? Like this?
Is the third year of the immersive horror game. So some of the characters people have now known for 4 years or so. So they have a relationship with certain characters that if they saw them on the street, they would want to give them a hug. Even though they've never met in real life.
That happens with my shows, like, a lot. Especially my first show I did that wasn't ABC Project, it was called Getting to Know You. But I had 8 actors as 8 characters, and they would speed dating style, like shift around the audience, but they were treating all the audience as the same person, just the next stage in the relationship. So you'd have like someone treating you as like an 18-year-old. They were training at Wendy's, and the next person treating you as like you know, this girl they're dating. But the way that it basically worked, though, was that you met these eight characters, each treating you more and more intimately than the last one. But people just like there's one of our actresses, Dasha. She played like a Russian con artist girlfriend, and people would come up to her. Like, people would be like, I know you, I've gone on a date with you, like, act like that with her constantly. Or we'd have people, you know, going up to the guy that was, like, kind of sexually harassy, bossy, and be like, dude, you're like, they, like, people just would constantly be coming up to them after that. It was insane. It was, like, more than any of my other shows, I feel like.
I think there's something to be said within the immersive world that when you're having these one-on-one interactions, or even if it's not officially one-on-one, within that immersive setting, people take, you know, some real personal ownership of the relationship that they have with these characters. And so, you know, in Blackout, we get the same exact thing where, you know, the actors, people want to talk to them and sort of treat them as the character, make sure they're okay, or, you know, tell them that they hate them or whatever. You know, we get a lot of that. That said, I do think that Blackout might be a little different than the other guys in terms of narrative, just in the sense that, you know, Chris and I share a theater background, and obviously story and narrative, you know, strongest, most important thing. That said, I think one of the strengths of Blackout is that when we started, we kind of let go of narrative. And we have a story that we're trying to tell, but it tends to be more effective for us if the audience member takes a whole sequence of events and characters and walks out saying, this is the story that I think happened. And 9 times out of 10, that never, ever lines up with the story that we're trying to tell. But that's great, because I think just for this particular piece, and this isn't the same for other projects that we work on, Blackout works when we let go of the narrative and we let other people take ownership of what's happening. And so for us, we will constantly try to sort of strip the show of story elements. So, you know, like, we don't really want a character, you know, calling another character dad. Because then, you know, the audience is like, okay, I get it. That's the father, and that's the daughter, and it's a, you know, whatever is happening. And that's not, we would rather have them meet those two characters, and maybe it's, you know, father-daughter, maybe it's uncle and niece. I don't know. Like, there are a million different iterations of it, and I think for Blackout, it tends to work better when the audience formulates the narrative.
I think also, you know, and interestingly, one of the things that we found is that the more, even if it's just on a subconscious level, if you can see where the story's going, the fear starts to subside. You know what I mean? It's when you don't know what's next, or it's like, wait a minute, that was like a really perpendicular move, you know what I mean? That then all of a sudden the unknown becomes much more sort of pleasant, and the fear and sort of like the desire to sort of be like, what's next? These things are coming out of nowhere. That actually heightens the fear for the people going through it.
And yeah, for me, like, the definitely a lot of it, because it can be so long form, is about seeding ideas and seeding things for later. So I had a project a long time ago called the Velocity Gnome project.
Oh, thank you.
It was basically a 5-year adventure for one person, where he was given a book that said he was the savior of mankind, and he would learn over the next 4 years that he was basically a John Connor type savior. And so each year, I would put things into the world that I didn't know what I was going to do with yet, but I'd hide something in a book I gave him, and then 3 years later, I would use what I put in there to answer something I needed. So just seeding is a big part of it. And again, just what people are seeing in your work, leaning into that. I felt a real kinship to, like, let them take away what they want, and then if you can also, for me, if I can also surprise and satisfy them, that's a big thing for me.
One of my favorite, sorry.
I was just going to say that I write a lot of traditional theater, too, and that's what I'm trained in, playwriting, TV writing, and stuff like that. So when I write a traditional theater piece, I try and create something where it has a narrative arc in that people will relate to it, and it's more broad in spectrum. I'm trying to create a narrative where, you know, it has the conflict, and every scene has an external or internal conflict, but an external or internal conflict that is coming out there for you to, for as many people to relate to as possible. In immersive pieces, I am focused on creating an internal conflict at every given. I'm more focused on internal conflict than external conflict, but internal conflict for the audience member. I mean, Covell was a piece where we did it as a game, so there was a little bit more external conflict, but a lot of our pieces have to do with asking people questions or putting them in situations where they're all of a sudden forced think about themselves, and it all leads back to you as an audience member, and the focus is on you. It's focused on you having to think, like, every single second, putting things out there for your brain to suddenly be, like, focusing back on yourself. It'll go external, but it will all be about the internal, and so I feel like regular playwriting is a little bit more like writing a novel, and immersive is more like writing a poem.
As an audience member, and it really stuck with me both with, I mean, all the shows this weekend, but I noticed it, Chalet and then Blackout, which I did within like 12 hours of each other, which was an interesting choice. But there is this like empty space where you can bring your own bullshit, for lack of a better word, and like the scenes become about, you know, personalized in that sense, and that seems to be where that magic happens. And you walk away shaken and rattled in all the good ways you want going into a piece. So another thing I want to talk about is, you know, I mentioned earlier how, you know, immersive covers a lot of different genres right now, and we're starting to see some of these things, not genres, like mediums, kind of like overlap, where, you know, VR companies are consulting with, you know, immersive creators, you know, theme parks are kind of like riffing off of everybody, and I was just wondering what your guys' thoughts were about how those forms are overlapping, if you ever had desires to play in other sandboxes yourselves.
I mean, I always want to try as many new things as possible. I like to put out impossible goals and try anything that's as difficult or new or interesting. I constantly like to teach myself new skills. I'll just do that. I want to do VR. I do photography for musicians as my day job usually. I really want to try and do VR music videos. We'll see if that happens.
We've been flirting with VR. We've done a couple of VR pieces, and then 21 was a piece that we designed that was sort of all into your shit. So it was sort of, you know, you're getting text messages, you're getting calls in the middle of the night, and you sort of, and it was to some part automated, but also a lot of people sort of projected their own stuff on it. And I think for us, that's one of the things that we want to be able to scale this so more people can see it. It's not, we love the singular person experience because I think it's emotionally, it's a really beautiful thing that we're able to do with our audience members. But at the same time, I think the great sort of pain of it is how few people get to see it. And that, certainly, like, that's a beautiful thing, and it's the rarefied aspect to it. But I think when listening to that question, I'm just like, I just want to get into everybody's stuff, and I'd love for more people to get to see this. So whatever way, whether it be VR, whether it be what we try to do with 21, whatever way we can get it to more people while maintaining the intimacy would be what I would want most.
I think, there's so much overlap, and there has been for so many years with so many different art forms in terms of the immersive world, and marketing, a lot of marketing departments have been doing immersive things for 3 years, and nobody looks at it as a piece of theater, but it's just, guerrilla marketing, sort of street underground theater thing. I think it applies to many different facets, and as Chris was saying, we worked trying to explore different versions of that. I'm kind of obsessed with, like, kids' theater right now. I think that, I would love to take all of this Blackout stuff, as silly as it sounds, and put it within, a children's show. Obviously not the content, but,
you guys didn't think he was going to go there.
It's a very new kind of Blackout show.
Blackout ABC is starting.
But, you know, like, I have a nephew that's six, and, you know, I take him to all these, you know, kids' museums and stuff, and I'm like, this is kind of just, like, what we do,
yeah.
You know? But rather than, like, a black piece of plastic, it's yellow. And, rather than, you know, like, a crazy, you know, murder-rape scene, it's actually, like, you know... I don't know a kid's cartoon, but it's
gonna,
like, you know...
You're going to be an astronaut.
Yeah, but it really is. I mean, I walk through these kids' museums, and I'm like, I could do this. This is what we do. So I think there is a really strong overlap. That's already happening. And it's just, you know, from a marketing perspective, from a kid's perspective, that it's also just the community and society is now starting to look at those things and going, oh, yeah, that's kind of just immersive theater, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... I draw a lot of inspiration from video games, especially like LucasArts adventure games is kind of where my heart always has been. Yeah, so I mean, I want people to feel that way, and I think that it, you know, like you're inside a world like that, and so definitely like video games are something I'm interested in as another genre, and also just exploring things that. Aren't, like, I love horror. I did not expect to be living in the horror genre as heavily as I am. I absolutely love it, but I want to explore other things as well, which I think connects with reaching broader audiences, reaching different audiences. Comedy is something I'm really excited about exploring in an immersive way. It's something that's on my list of to-dos. So I think there's other ways and other ways that people like to experience. I think horror is so passionate. You guys are up for anything all the time, which is why it's so awesome. But other audiences are a lot more timid, and I want to figure out and keep cracking away at how do I get you to say yes to something that may seem frightening or may seem counterintuitive to what you think of as fun. But because anyone who does anything immersive usually comes out changed in some way, and I think if people... if a broader audience or a different audience knew were willing to take that chance, we would all these boats would rise up with the tide. So I think that's exciting to me because it's happening. It's already happening.
And like the Blackout guys were saying, I mean, I also really would love to work with a marketing company and do stuff with that. And also, there's a lot of things that going on. It's kind of crazy. I'm not like a big EDM person. But last year, I just got into like photographing a lot of EDM for work. Someone liked my EDM stuff, and they started sending me off to a bunch of different EDM festivals for clients. And EDM festivals have all of these really cool immersive elements to them. Like there was at one festival I went to, like a secret 90s bar. That you had, like, deep house 90s bar that you had to, like, follow through a bunch of clues to get into this 90s deep house bar hidden inside there. And then, you know, sometimes the festivals will have themes. So, like, next weekend, I'm not going to this, but they took over Renaissance Fair site grounds in Texas, and they're going to do a medieval-themed... EDM festival there with like dragon stage and like knights were throughout it. I went to a Alice in Wonderland themed one, and like all of a sudden you'd be surrounded by nymphs and fairies, and there were like you go to these festivals and they're just super thematic. And I personally would love. I've been like toying with the idea of creating like a secret dance cult. Like night where like people are like initiated into a cult, and if you stop dancing, you're kicked out of the cult. So like the longer you dance, the more of the show you get to see. But if you get tired, then you also get to have the experience of like being kicked out of the cult and like destroyed. Like so, I want to do something like that.
I'm gonna pitch something here. You could probably monetize that as a fitness program.
Some weird immersive version of they shoot horses, don't they? Really, that's a good idea.
Awesome. Well, like we have a little bit of time left, so I just want to actually throw this to the audience to see if you guys had any questions, because it's an awesome, obviously an amazing opportunity to talk to all these people here in one place. So does anybody here in the audience have questions for anybody?
Questions for the Blackout people. Just because your show has been around so long and because it's so extreme, I imagine that the audience members and the actors or creators, you get some people who are extremists and some people who are more pushing themselves to get there. Can you talk about the different experiences of working with those two different types of people?
Sure. Just for anyone that couldn't hear, basically the question was, there's a whole spectrum of audience members that come through these things. Some are, you know, really pushing themselves to get there. Some are, you know, there and then some and are ready to kill everybody. And how do you sort of deal with all those people? I think for us, it's so much about, and whether it's us as creators or the actors that are doing it, you have to, like, just take a deep breath and drop into the person who's there in the room with you. And you'd be so surprised if you were to watch the security camera footage or whatever, how different every single show is. And it's like the physical chapters are exactly the same. And, you know, they start here, then they move here, then they move here. But the differences in terms of how they get people from, you know, one spot to another changes so drastically. And it's just really about the actors sort of dropping in and sort of looking at the audience member and kind of saying, where are you right now, and jumping onto that page. That said, as Chris said earlier, you know, safety is a really big thing for us. And if you do get somebody that comes in and is really, like, you know, sort of like, hail Satan, Blackout, let's do this, like, let's raise the devil, we're kind of like, what? You have to accept that there are a lot of people in the horror community that kind of have that extreme nature, and they love the show, and that's great, and we'll give it to them. But there's also a lot of, like, safety elements, as Chris was talking about. So everyone's going to get hugged and be touched really close, and you can do that really aggressively or you can do that really softly, but everyone's going to be held to make sure that those arms are not flailing and we're not getting punched.
And also, just to piggyback on that a little bit, I think that idea of an actor being present with you is such a huge thing, as I'm sure it is for all of us. You mentioned it a little bit earlier, but we were really inspired by a lot of performance artists like the Marina Abramović of the world. You know, and this idea that if there's a moment where I, like, lean back and I'm like, God, his acting is amazing. Like, you've already lost, you know what I mean? And so one of the things that our actors are so good at is gauging who this person is, being present with them, but being so inside of them that you don't actually have a moment to step back and have a moment to sort of judge this person or be like, I love this actor. Later, you're like, oh my God, that actor was amazing. But in it, you don't have that moment to have any distance for it. And I think that's one of the hardest things for our actors to gauge. And the more they do it, that's the thing. That's the skill set that they really learn.
Actually, I'm going to jump in with another question. When you are casting for your shows, what do you look like? It has to be a different skill set than looking necessarily for a film or television actor.
Kindness. Like, we want people who are kind and want to sort of explore into this world and dip a toe in it. But there's a lot of people, we get a lot of people auditioning for us who, I think, want to cathart something out of their lives. And that's, we're like, that's not the person. So we actually look for people who have a little bit of trepidation.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can do this. And like that's exactly the muscle we want you to have so that we can... Because, you know, we talk about it as like the objectivity clause. It's like you wrap your hands around 30 necks a night. You know what I mean? They just get tighter and tighter and tighter because you lose your objectivity. So you want to have people who can always check in with their objectivity in order to keep it safe.
I usually look for people that are really good at just naturally, like, having a conversation with me. Like, if it's a stranger that just comes up to me and starts talking to me, and I'm like, oh, I'm like, do you act? And they're like, yeah, I'm an actor. I'm like, have you done improv before? And they're like, yeah, I've done improv. I'm like, yeah, probably. I probably want to, like, have a 20-minute lunch with you and see how I feel about casting you. I don't cast people unless I do, like, this 20-minute interview process with them, where I go through with them the roles that they have enjoyed playing most, the roles that they're sick of being typecast as, and the roles that they haven't been given an opportunity to play that they're excited, that they wish that they were. So I like kind of working within those boundaries, like thinking right away about why they liked the roles that they've enjoyed playing in the past, what they exactly are sick of being cast is and avoiding writing a part that includes that and what they really want to. Because it's very tiring work for actors to do immersive theater, and I want to create a role that they're so excited to play that it feels a little bit less like work for them. And so, because, you know, I have a rule where I try and make sure that I pay every single one of my actors. I've run into some issues where people complain to me about ticket price. I'm like, I have to pay my actors because we're getting to know you. We did pay what you can for some shows, and we didn't make enough money for me to be able to pay my actors, and I just felt guilty the whole time. But I try and always make sure I pay them, but it's not that much money, and I want to make sure that they feel like they're getting a lot out of it. And they also get a lot out of, like, interacting with audience members and seeing how they emotionally react to them. But I also want to write something particularly for them. So I look for people who are natural fits and for people that I can really write a good role for on a project.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I definitely need trust, like 100% with everyone. It's very important when casting. And conversationally, again, it's so conversational. I need to know that these people are people I would want to have a conversation with, or who I do have conversations with. So that to me, like, I want, usually, their character to be as close to them or some aspect of them as possible. I want, like, if I have a character who's very excited, I will cast someone I know who is a very excitable person. I don't want them to be taking up bandwidth in their brain with having to do other things when there's so many other swinging parts, that I want them to already feel like they are that, and it, or yeah, to be those characters.
Right, right. Any other audience questions? Yeah.
One of the things that I personally love about immersive theater is the fact that it allows the audience to take away from whatever they need. What I'm actually very curious about. You guys as creatives, what do you take away from the creative process?
The question was, what do we take away from the creative process? I personally, as an artist, want to have people have as many, like, as much, I want to change the world. I want to change the world. I think the best way to change the world, though, is to make people emotionally grow, and it just feels so amazing to have so many people leaving my shows, like, after being in a 10-minute experience, like, you know, Apartment 8 or / the Chalet, having people come out crying and needing a hug, like, that's, like, just, like, feels so good because you're, like, I've made an impact on this person. And, like, just having people just have that feeling and just, you know, you can feel it in a room when people feel like they've been changed in some way. And I just want to have that happen as much as possible and have as many people grow and think as possible.
It's a good question. I think, for me, dismissibility is the thing that terrifies me. And I think we live in a world where everybody sort of just coasts through life. So I think by being indismissible, when you watch people walk out, having really be coming out, going in A and leaving Z, that's, I think, the most, and I think it's similar to what you're saying, but for us, it's not always just emotional, it can be a lot of different ways, but I think so much art and so much entertainment, particularly whether it be TV or sort of standard theatrical productions, everybody goes in, presses pause on their life for 2 hours, and then leaves kind of the same. And I think that's my greatest fear. So I don't want to speak on the negative, but that would be, I think, when that doesn't happen is when I feel good about something I've made.
I feel like my answer is going to be, like, really selfish and not so artsy, but but I mean, it's true. I think the moments that I feel that I get the most out of and that I feel, like, really accomplished are, you know, kind of
moments when the show is happening and I'm sitting in the back of the room and it's so foggy and it's so loud and I can't hear anything and I can kind of see the actors doing their thing and I can kind of see the audience member crying or screaming or like whatever. But there's just something that clicks. It's an environment. And it's a big thing. Like, I have a really big thing with concerts, like rock concerts when I grew up. Like, to me, that is like the most amazing theatrical experience. Like, people like Nine Inch Nails and Madonna, like when they make those like crazy ass rock concerts, and I just stand there kind of being like, wow, I'm in the middle of this insane environment, and I just believe it in every fiber of my being, and yeah, that's what I get out of it. Like it's just kind of selfish, but there was a moment last night where I was telling somebody earlier this morning where I was sitting in a closet upstairs in a hotel room, watching one of our scenes unfold, and I was just kind of watching it through the mirror, and I was like, this is awesome. Like, these lights are great. The fog is perfect right now. The sound levels are, like, just right. The actors are doing their thing. The audience member is, like, exactly where he needs or she needs to be, and it all clicked, and I kind of went, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, I have no voice. I've slept maybe 3 hours in a couple days here. But there's these moments where exactly like that, where you're just sitting and looking at these irreproducible memories, and you're just like, okay, that was kind of awesome. Like, that was super fun, and like you can see in people's eyes that they will always remember a moment, and that's huge for me. Like, just something that is special. You've made someone feel special and unique, and it's that they're going to hold on to that and live with that feeling forever. And it becomes worth it, even on days my voice sounds like this and I can barely stand up. But yeah, it's all totally worth it in those moments when you see like someone register that like that this is something they'll always remember.
Kind of like going off of that, I've done a lot of immersive theater, and one of the pieces I went to was this thing called Hotel Savoy in New York, and it was actually a German piece, and it was brought over to the United States for like a month and a half, and they got to use the Goethe Institute as a hotel, because they originally did it at the actual Hotel Savoy in Germany, but at the Goethe Institute, they recreated it there, and tickets were just so cheap for what it was. It was $15 because they had a huge grant. And, I mean, I got to go to this thing, and it was just, you walked through. It was one audience member at a time. They let people in every 15 minutes. And you went through this entire building. There's, like, a room where all of a sudden you're in where two people are speaking a language you don't know, and you're just stuck in a room with them, and they're having a fight over their card game, and they're trying to, like, talk to you. Like, I don't know. But one of the most amazing moments was just being in the kitchen and having one of the bellboys come in and just start talking to you and feeling like you had a conversation with this person, but you want to add to that conversation, but you can't because it's not real. When you're on your way home and you want to tell this person something to add to the conversation, it's not real. And it creates this nostalgia for something it creates the sense of something that you just can't get back. And I like the idea of just creating something where you have such an emotional connection to it because it is a special moment that you can never get back. And every single show, even if you come back multiple times to see my show, you're going to have a different experience with it each time because you're a different person every single day because you've had different experiences. You have different memories to draw upon. So you will continue to have these unique, untouchable experiences.
Nice. Any other hands? Cool. Well, I just want to say, thank you again for coming out, and thank you everybody for talking here. It's been really cool to talk about this stuff. And if you hadn't played the game yet, play the game. If you're about to try Blackout or Shelley, get ready. If you haven't, try to find a way if it's all possible and everything's like sold out. But more importantly, just thank you to Annie Lesser, Josh Randall, and Chris Thor, and Dylan Reeve. So many cool works in one place for everybody to try out in the first place.
I just saw a message ahead of time.